Welcome back, dear students, and we're going to now discuss stock markets. We often say the stock market, but it's actually several different markets. Where are stocks traded? How does this system work? So get out your study guide or take notes, because it's a little involved, but once you study it a few times. Some people out there can look at it once and they know it. I'm not one of them. It's pretty straightforward. The first category we need to discuss is the primary versus the secondary market. The primary market is the market in which new issues of securities are sold to the public. You will hear the term IPO, initial public offering, the first public sale of a company stock. Going public, taking the company public. Most retail investors simply do not participate in the primary market. And obviously there are exceptions and every individual is different. But my recommendation is that we really shouldn't. First of all, if you do get involved in the IPO market, you normally have a broker and have a lot of money. Because they don't want you to just come up with, I got a few hundred dollars. No. They want you to commit to putting in a good chunk of change. And if it is really a hot offering, that's exactly what they call them, hot offering, it's going to be difficult to even find some shares, find a broker that's going to give you shares unless you have a long relationship with them and plenty of moolah. The secondary market, now you're never going to hear that term, but that's what it's called. The secondary market is the market in which securities are traded after they've been issued to the public. This is the market that we participate in. The vast majority of transactions every day, billions of shares trading hands, are in the secondary market. So that's where we're going to work. That's where we're going to find the stocks that we're interested in. Companies that have been around for decades, maybe some new hot issues, but no. We're going to deal with boring old companies, and they're on the secondary market. Now, the primary market is very important, folks, because this is how capitalism works, right? Companies want to go public. Why? Why would you want to take your company public? I mean, you own this company. Wouldn't you rather just stay private? Well, it turns out no. There are several reasons why companies will issue stock and go public. To raise money, or start or expand a business. To help pay for ongoing business expenses. So you have this great idea or this great enterprise that's going to change the world, and you need some funding. Well, you can't go to the bank. They're not going to give you $500 million or $1 billion. You go to the stock market, and then you have to sell your idea to first the investment bankers, who then have to sell it to investors. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it works spectacularly. Sometimes it doesn't work. And in some cases, some companies that need tremendous sums of money are using the stock market to continue to fund their operations. This is typical of a lot of the companies here in San Diego that are biotech companies. They don't have any revenue whatsoever, and they have people who are paid very good at salaries because they're little geniuses coming out of UCSD and the like. And so they need more cash. So they will have a secondary offering. They've already gone public, but now they need more cash, because if you're trying to create a drug from scratch, it can cost anywhere from $500 million to $1 billion or more. Yeah, and then there's no guarantee that the stuff won't turn your liver into pate. So very dangerous, very speculative. As a way to gain prestige and respect within the investment and industrial communities. Yeah, once you get large enough, it's just simply expected that you're going to go public. There's a wonderful story about Google making money hand over fist, and the founders were thinking, maybe we really don't want to go public. And then Wall Street was knocking on their doors, and enticing him with literally billions of dollars. And they said, okay, let's go public. And the Facebook, Faceplant, I'm sorry, Facebook, right. The owner, you've all heard of him, Mark Zuckerberg, when they went public, his California tax bill alone was $1 billion. His California tax bill. So yes, how would you like to do, be paying that much taxes? That means you've made billions, right? And so is that something that interests you? Mm-hmm. Could you see yourself eating, sleeping, breathing 16 hours a day, making this company get off the ground, making this pig to fly, as they sometimes say, 7 years, and then have a competitor beat you to it? Yes, it's capitalism, folks. The rewards are great, and the stress is tremendous. And as we just said, a reward for those who are starting the business. But also, think about it, folks. Once a company becomes sufficiently large, how do you divvy up the spoils? How do you sell the company to anything other than a huge entity? No, you sell to the public, and then people can divvy up the spoils. The people who started the company can sell their parts of the company to other investors, or maybe pass it on to their heirs. Yeah, if you're one of the people who started GE, Coca-Cola, or Walmart, how would you sell your share of the business? Now, one of the interesting things is some companies have decided to stay private. Some very large companies, you may have heard of them. You ever eat a Snickers bar? You can buy shares in Hershey or Mondelez. Those are the people, that's the people who makes Oreos. But you can't buy shares in Mars, the people who make Snickers and M&Ms. One of the largest companies is a food company called Cargill. You might have heard of HEB. I'm not sure what the H and the E stands for, but his last name is Butts, who started the supermarket chain in the South. I don't think they're out here in the West yet. Who else? In-N-Out Burger. And there's a wonderful story for those of you who are interested in businesses and business stories, because once the couple that started the company passed away, it then went to the heirs. And there was at first a pretty public fight about how the company should evolve. Now, you see, if it were a public institution, there's a board of directors. It was a publicly traded corporation. There's officers and the like. So that kind of family feud can still happen depending on who owns all the shares, but it is less likely. So check out the story of In-N-Out Burgers, especially because people love them. I mean, you go past that place and there's a line just of cars, you know, half a block down the block. Slide number 15. Continuing, why should you go public? Well, think about it, folks. Once you've sold a piece of yourself, you don't have to repay the money. The corporation is under no obligation to repurchase the shares of the stock. Unlike a bond where they're borrowing money, they have to pay it back. When they sell the parts of the company, they are not required to buy them back. The shareholder may or may not be able to find someone who will purchase the shares from them. If it's a real company, we use the term bona fide. If it's an ongoing enterprise, what is the IRS use the term? Going concern. Means it's a real company, folks. They're actually selling products and services. They're making money. You're going to find somebody to buy your shares. If it's a scam, which a lot of them are, the penny stocks, you may not be able to find somebody to buy your shares. But now, once you have gone public, you have certain rights and responsibilities that private companies just don't have to worry about. If you've taken Business 120, Introduction to Business, you've learned about sole proprietorships and partnerships and corporations. Corporations have many responsibilities. If you go to Mars or HEB and say, how much money did you make last year? How much cash do you have on hand? They would say, excuse me, who are you? Are you the IRS? You know, no. But a public corporation must file every quarter the financial situation of their company, how much money they earned, a whole slew of information that we'll look at when we get to Chapter 5 on financial statements. And they must file these 10-Ks annually and 10-Qs. And this is where I really miss being in the classroom, because what I would do is I say, now, what's that annual report? And the students would look at me and go, 10-K. I say, yeah, good. Now, what's the quarterly report? And they'd go, 10-Q. And I said, what was that? 10-Q. And then I'd say, you're welcome. And I crack up, and the students look at me like, this guy's really nuts. But I love really bad jokes. I mean, they must have at least one public meeting annually where shareholders can come and vote and air their grievances. This is a cute story about Sempra Energy, SDG&E, here in San Diego, the utility company. They're based here in San Diego, and they would have their annual meeting here. Well, they made some boneheaded maneuvers a couple decades ago, and shareholders would come and rake them over the coals at the annual meeting. So one year they said, well, we don't really want to deal with this anymore. So they had their annual meeting in London, one of the most expensive cities in the world. And they said, you want to come and yell at us? Yeah, you come in to London. They didn't say that. They said, oh, we want to get our officers and board of directors to understand the opportunities in Europe. BS. They just didn't want to have to listen to people screaming and hollering how stupid they were. And let's finish slide number 15 here with a discussion of IPOs. Look, folks, IPOs, initial public offerings, do not usually live up to their expectations. I mean, some do, obviously. But the typical IPO loses 50% of its value within 1 year. Yeah. Facebook, within a few months, had lost 50%. And then it zoomed ahead, and it's done very, very well. Google, right out of the bat, went up about 100%. And then skyrocketed from there. So it's very iffy, right? The IPOs are exactly for everyone Google, everyone Facebook. There are dozens of, you don't even know what I'm talking about. Who is it? Lycos and Altos and Yahoo, of course. They're still around. But Dogpile, Go, Ask Jeeves, they're all gone, right? All the other search engines are gone. So it's competition, folks, and it can be brutal. And when you take the Series 7 exam, the Registered Representative General Securities, whatever it's called, the Series 7, everybody calls it, you'll be expected to know all about the IPO process. So we don't spend a whole lot of time on it in our class because it's just not that important for the vast majority of us retail investors, in my humble opinion. And you might decide otherwise, but... if you do, then you really want to bone up on what the IPO process is all about and get in good with a broker somewhere. Slide number 16, the secondary markets. Okay, finally. Okay, I'm sorry. I've been digressing with cute little stories. Let's get to work on the secondary markets because these are the markets that are most important to us. When people talk about the stock market, they are almost always referring to the secondary market, which are actually several markets. They provide liquidity, which is a fancy word for can you sell your shares, can you buy the shares, an easy method for transferring ownership, and a fairly efficient mechanism for pricing and valuing your securities. Oh, in other words, you have 100 shares of IBM or whatever company, and your banker wants to know what kind of assets you have because you're considering a loan. And you could say, well, here's 100 shares, and they're selling for X amount of dollars on the New York Stock Exchange. And the banker would say, yeah, okay, we believe you have that value. We believe you have those assets on your books. Now, traditionally, this is a few decades ago, there were two types of secondary markets. There were the organized securities exchanges. Exchanges, you've heard of the Securities and Exchange Commission, right? These were centralized locations in which transactions are made in outstanding securities using the double auction market, face-to-face people screaming and yelling and hollering, and maybe you've seen some videos of that. It's all gone now. It's all electronic. And then there was the OTC market, the widely scattered telecommunication networks through which transactions were made in outstanding securities and smaller initial public offerings. This was a quote-based system, and then it moved to online. At first, it was, when they said widely scattered telecommunication network, it was widely scattered. It was somebody in Minneapolis, somebody else in Atlanta, and then somebody else in Denver, and they'd call each other on the phone, and these people took lessons in how to be rude to one another. You got 100 shares of that or 1,000 shares of that penny stock XYZ or whatever? Oh, yeah, how much you want for them? $25. And then they would slam the phone and call back and say, I'll give you $22 or whatever. And it's all gone, folks. It's all outdated. This is an outdated comparison. Due to technological advances and mergers and acquisitions, the traditional differences between the two have been erased. And the changes, I shouldn't really say they're just getting started. They are started. And what we heard a few years ago, so maybe I should revise this, but what we heard about 15 years ago and up until about 5 or 6 years ago, you don't hear too much about it anymore. Every once in a while you see an article talking about it. There was a movement to create 24-hour, 7-day-a-week trading because it's all electronic, so you don't need a whole lot of people to keep the thing darn thing running. And you don't hear too much about that anymore. So I don't know what's going on with that. I guess people just said, no, we don't need to be able to sell our shares of McDonald's at 2 a.m. in the morning. Slide number 18. Historically, all trading on the securities was conducted on the exchange floor. Trading was conducted using a double auction. Instead of one seller, multiple buyers that you see in an estate or a farm auction, that's what you're used to, or maybe an art world where there's one person calling out prices and the buyers in the audience are accepting the prices. No, there are multiple sellers, multiple buyers, all calling out prices and quantities. And so it looks like madness until you get close to it and see that, oh no, they're making deals here. Yeah, okay. And we, in the face-to-face class, would show a video. We can't really show it online. It's copyrighted. But you can, what I should do is just go find some ones that are on YouTube and link to them. That's what I'll do. Let me write that down so I don't forget. Look for some ones that are on YouTube, and then we don't have to worry about copyright. It's all YouTube's problem. But due to the technology and the sheer massive volume of shares traded, things have changed. Almost all of trading is now conducted electronically. You know, there's still some trades on the floor of the exchanges, and I think the only reason is for television. Really? I mean, most of the, when they show a view of the floor, most people are just standing around talking to one another. And every once in a while, they say, hey, somebody wants to buy 1,000 shares of this. You got some? Oh, yeah, I do. And so most of them are just standing around. And there's this one guy they love. He's very photogenic. He's got white hair and a great beard. And I forget his name, Peter something or other. He's just really popular because he's so photogenic. And when he got COVID and was sick for quite a while, the investment world was concerned about him. It was amazing. So you'll see him. You'll see him. He's got the beard, wonderful beard, and white hair, and really, really photogenic kind of guy. But that's the only, from my humble opinion, I think that's the only reason they keep the darn thing around is for television. Because there's, I forget how much, but it's far less than 1%. I don't know the number, but it's very few shares trade hands face to face. It's all electronic. Now, who's the granddaddy of them all? The big board, the New York Stock Exchange. Started in 1792 when Wall Street really was next to a wall, it was traditionally responsible for over 90% of the volume of transactions, about 2,300 companies worth about $27 trillion of market capitalization, over 2 billion shares traded daily, and this is as of February 2024. Companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange must meet the stringent requirements. They were traditionally the largest and most prestigious. That's not true anymore, as we'll see. They are not the they're mostly large companies, folks, and they are mostly prestigious, but they have been leapfrogged by companies on another exchange that we'll take a look at. And if you continue to falter, if your company keeps going down the porcelain oasis and you wind up in bankruptcy or whatever, they kick you off. And poor Kodak. You've heard of Kodak, haven't you? The name still lives on, but the company is a shell of what it used to be, because they used to sell those little yellow boxes of film in every convenience store, every drugstore, every grocery store, because people used film. It's interesting. Kodak is the company that actually created, designed, brought to the world the digital camera. They created the technology that put them out of business. So the New York Stock Exchange, the big board. It's still bigger than their competitor, but not by much. Big changes at the New York Stock Exchange. In 2005, they purchased this Archipelago Electronic Exchange and the Pacific Regional Exchange, which we'll see in a few slides here. They then changed from a partnership to a publicly traded corporation in March of 2006, and merged with an electronic exchange in Europe. They were phasing out the face-to-face double auction trading in favor of exclusively trading electronically. And as we said, there's still a few trades done face-to-face, but I think it's only just for television. And then in 2011, Germany's stock market in Frankfurt, the Börse, I hope I'm saying that right, tried to purchase the New York Stock Exchange. But the European regulators said no. Not the United States regulators, the European regulators. And then in 2013, they were acquired for approximately $11 billion by a 13-year-old derivatives trading firm from Atlanta, the Intercontinental Exchange. So this is a company that didn't exist until the year 2000, buying an entity that's been around since 1792. In 1992, on their 200th birthday, if you had told the folks at the New York Stock Exchange the next 20 years would see far more changes than their first 200 years, they would have thought you were quite insane. But you would have been right. Because it's not the same entity it was for those 200 years. Indeed. The floor brokers. Again, these people are gone. You used to see them running around and screaming and hollering at one another. The independent brokers, the house brokers. House brokers worked for different houses, like Morgan Stupid or Merrill Stench. I'm sorry, Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch. And the independent brokers would be like gig workers. They would find jobs where they needed them. They're all gone. They were very worried that the New York Stock Exchange's aggressive moves to all electronic trading meant the end of their way of life. But it really isn't the end, folks. It's just a big change from face-to-face interaction to sitting in front of a computer screen all day. Does this sound familiar? Here I am, sitting in front of a computer screen, recording the presentation, and there you are, listening to it or watching it at a different time and place. Yeah, brave new world. Slide 22. The specialists. Now, the specialists are also gone, and the one video that we would show in class really was really well done because it showed the specialists doing their job. These were stock exchange members who specialized in making transactions in one or more stocks. The job of the specialist was to manage the auction process. They bought and sold stock from their own inventory to provide a continuous, fair, and orderly market. So think about this, folks. All of a sudden, this one company, it got some really bad news, and nobody wants to buy. Everybody's trying to sell. What's going to happen to the price? It's going to plummet. The job of the specialist is to say, okay, I'm going to get in there and start buying. Or likewise, on the other side, you know, all of a sudden there's really good news and everybody wants to buy and nobody wants to sell and the price starts to skyrocket. They have to get in there and sell. This role has been essentially squeezed out by technology and the tremendous volume of trading. They are now involved in only a tiny amount of trading, and they were replaced by what are called designated market makers. Remember that term, market makers. We're going to come back to it in a bit. Or supplementary liquidity providers. Back in 2009. From time to time, the specialists were either praised or maligned. Because you can imagine there's every once in a while there'd be a little bit of hanky-panky going on with the specialists. But no, it worked fairly well for decades. Suffice to say, though, that they were trying to make a profit just like everybody else. While their goal may seem altruistic and that they're, I don't know how to use the word sacrifice, but everybody's trying to buy, and your job is to sell, everybody's trying to sell, your job is to buy. They made sure that when the market received benefits from their efforts, so did they. But as we said, they've morphed into electronic, and we're going to come back to this term, market makers, because that's the term we often hear. Now, the New York Stock Exchange was the 800-pound gorilla. Who's the monkey on the curb? That was the American Exchange. I'm sorry, the American Stock Exchange, or the Amex. It was also called the curb. The curb? And you hear some old-timers still call it the curb. Where did that name come from? Because they literally started outside the New York Stock Exchange on the curb. They'd be looking in the window and seeing what's going on, and then they'd be outside trading. It gets cold in New York in the wintertime. So they eventually got a building down the street. They've always were tinier than the New York Stock Exchange, only 3% of the volume. And so they saw the handwriting on the wall in the early 90s and started concentrating on securities other than stocks over, almost 30 years now. As it changes, about 30 years now. The ETFs, remember those? The exchange-traded funds? They were started on the Amex. Because the Amex, so we got to do something, right? Because they're seeing the New York Stock Exchange. They're never going to get as big as the New York Stock Exchange. And then they see this other guy, the NASDAQ, who is coming, we're going to get to the NASDAQ in a little bit, is getting huge. And they go, oh, let's try something different. And then guess what happened? The NASDAQ bought them in 1998 and said, okay, we're going to buy you. And then they kicked them to the curb, ha ha ha, pun intended, in 2004. And then they were acquired by the New York Stock Exchange in 2008. So they moved them down the street to the same building as the New York Stock Exchange, and they changed the name to NYSE MICKET, or MKT, or Market, or whatever. Not a dumb name. Finally, they've changed the name to the New York Stock Exchange American, but people still call them the Amex, the American Exchange. Tiny, small. The regional exchanges were modeled after the New York Stock Exchange and the Amex, and they only, at their peak, counted for 4%. So there was one in Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Denver, Cincinnati. And here's the tricky part. The Pacific Exchange is actually two locations, one in San Francisco, one in LA. Many of the securities listed on the regional exchanges were also available in the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, so you probably wanted to buy them there. Traditionally, the regional exchanges were often places where undesirable or unethical issues were sold. Lately, or actually starting about 20-some years ago, the regional exchanges have tried to diversify and differentiate themselves from the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ in order to survive. So, for example, the Philadelphia Exchange started concentrating in semiconductor stocks. So they became specialists in chip stocks. Make sense? And then, as we said, unethical or undesirable issues, Denver Exchange was famous for companies that were not quite as bad as we're going to see when we get to the pink sheets and the bulletin board, but not good companies. So you heard somebody say, I bought this stock on the Denver Exchange. They told me it's going to, And plus the regional exchanges have not been immune to the rush to consolidate. The New York Stock Exchange bought the Pacific Exchange. The NASDAQ bought the Philadelphia Exchange. Biggerer and biggerer and biggerer. To quote Dr. Seuss. Slide 25. Options and futures. What are they? Well, we said, remember the options and futures, right? They are the very speculative, very dangerous things that we call derivatives. Well, they have their own exchanges. The Chicago Board Options Exchange and the Chicago Board of Trade. And it made sense that they at least the futures would start in Chicago, because that's where all the pork came through and the wheat and everything. And then the options are just gambling. But we'll discuss options and futures in detail later. But now those things are also traded on the major exchanges and the regional exchanges. So everybody's getting into everybody else's cookie jar, right? And we're going to see the CBOE tried to buy, we're going to see how they're all trying to buy each other. But remember, all you have to know about derivatives for now, until we get to them later on in the semester, is that they derive their value from another asset, and they're incredibly risky. Yes, you can make a ton of money overnight and then lose it all the next day. That's not investing. Slide 26, the over-the-counter market. Now, I don't really understand the name over-the-counter. I mean, basically, it just means you're going directly to the person who owns the shares, the dealer, the market maker. But as we said, they started out as widely scattered telecommunication networks through which transactions of securities would be made. There were no single location as with an exchange. So as we said, people would be calling each other up and trying to make deals over the phone. They were quote-based systems. They still are. They're quote-based systems, as opposed to the double auction where people are screaming and hollering at one another. How that works, we talk a little bit about in the next presentation. And there are three tiers. The NASDAQ, which is very adamantly opposed to having you tell them the OTC. They hate that. They don't want to be associated with that. Why? Because of these two puppies right here. The bulletin board and the pink sheets, now called the markets group. Now these places, folks, this is where those penny stocks that we refer to, scam companies, if you saw the Wolf of Wall Street or Boilerplate company, it's Hollywood, but it's the idea. These are not real companies. They're scams. They're somebody's garage starting in one of those states that starts with the letter I, like Idaho or Iowa. In fact, in the movie Wolf of Wall Street, it's a very, it's kind of raw, very salacious, lots of sex and drugs and the like. But there's some excellent parts where they show you exactly how these things are done. They're not real companies. And he's talking up this company on the phone. And then in the movie, they cut to somebody's garage in Iowa. So I used that before the movie came out. So these guys you want to stay away from. And why did they call them the pink sheets? Because they used to publish a newspaper that on pink paper. So they called them the pink sheets. They're trying to clean up their act. At least that's what they say publicly. But no, folks. Stay away. This is the wrong side of the tracks. The red light district, the bad side of town, just wrong. Stay away. And we'll talk about how these guys scam you. I'm sorry, make money in an ancillary presentation. Dealers. Market makers. You hear the term dealer or market makers, not brokers. Brokers make money off the buying and selling, the commission. Dealers make money off the spreads. They will offer, they create an inventory. That they've taken the place of the specialists. They create an inventory of the stock, and they will buy and sell from you, from that inventory to you, buy, sell to you, and buy from you. Whereas brokers simply act as a go-between. They don't typically keep an inventory, although some brokerage firms now act as dealers, so it gets a little confusing. But how do these people make money if they're not charging a commission? What they are doing is they are selling you the security at a certain price, and then they are buying it back at another price. Now, the terms are ask and bid, and people have a tough time with that. If you just think of the word ask. If you have to ask for the price, it's going to be more, right? I would, if it were up to me, I'd call the ask price the retail price. That's the price the dealer offers to sell the security. And then the wholesale price. That's how much they will buy it back from you. And the difference is called the spread, the bid-ask spread. That's how the market makers, the dealers, the specialists, that's how they made money. Brokers make money off a commission. So now you're saying, well, Payano, I have Robinhood. I don't pay a commission. Yeah, you're right. You don't pay a commission, but how are you getting charged? You don't think you're actually doing it for free, do you? Yes, we're going to discuss that in detail when we see the Casas de Cambio presentation. And just think about it, folks. If you're buying the shares at $25.20 and then you're selling them back at $25.10, there's a 10-cent spread, isn't there? And that's how the market makers make money. And what they do is they kick some of that back. It's called payment for order flows, or just order flow. They kick some of it back to the brokerage firm. So this is where I'm going to repeat myself over several times, so my apologies. But this is really gets my dander up, because companies like Robinhood has really mainstreamed it. They say, oh, you don't pay a commission, trade as often as you want, right? It's all free. Wrong. Wrong. Every time you trade, you're getting hit you're paying more than what the going perfect price is, the best price available, and you're getting less when you sell. And so the more you trade, the more you pay. Plus, we're going to learn, or hopefully we've gotten this germ of an idea in your head, trading is the loser's game. You want to think long term. You don't want to buy the stock for 2 weeks or 2 days or 2 minutes. No, that's my humble opinion, and you're going to hear people talk otherwise. So, dealers, market makers. Now, let's continue the discussion here, because I got ahead of myself a little bit. Unlike brokers who charge a commission, dealers and market makers make money from the spread of the bid and ask prices. And we're going to see a presentation called Casas de Cambio. It's an ancillary presentation. Make sure you check it out. We would, of course, in the face-to-face class, cut to it, but we won't do that now. Just as the Casas de Cambio, the money exchange houses in San Isidro and on the other side of the border, Tijuana, and lots of places along the borders between countries, and then we go to tourist locations, they make money on the difference between the prices in which they buy and sell pesos and dollars. So the dealer's markups or markdowns are not reported to the customers, whereas the broker's commissions are reported. So come on, folks. How do you think the internet brokers make money on $5 trade or $7 or now $0 a trade? We'll come back to this idea. Check out the Casas de Cambio presentation, and we'll come back to this idea in detail in our next presentation when we talk about transactions and the cost of transactions. Okay, now, finally, I'm sorry I've been dancing around this NASDAQ. What is this NASDAQ? Well, it stood for many years, the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. They don't even want you to remember that. They just want you to just call us the NASDAQ. Forget that whole National Association of Securities Dealers. Because the National Association of Securities Dealers was the non-governmental organization that used to be responsible for self-regulation of registered representatives. They gave up that role. They are now the NASDAQ, and they are not nonprofit anymore. That role is now done by FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, and we'll play with them a little bit. We're going to use their website to check out bonds. And you can also check out your brokerage firm, on your potential broker or brokerage firm on FINRA, see if they've done any hanky-panky. The NASDAQ created the first electronics communication networks for trading securities back in 1971. This is before the internet, folks. They had their own AOL, and some of you don't even remember AOL, but they had their own electronic system. And now they provide up-to-date bid and ask prices on approximately 3,300 stocks. The NASDAQ used to be the arena for small companies to get started, and once they became large enough, it was just expected they would move to the New York Stock Exchange. But starting in the 1980s and then in the 1990s, many prestigious companies decided, no, we're very happy here on the NASDAQ, and we're not going to move to the New York Stock Exchange. You might have heard of some of them. Apple, Microsoft, Intel, yeah, Google, Amazon, right? So now you see why the NASDAQ is now threatening the predominance of the New York Stock Exchange, because the largest companies in the world are no longer on the New York Stock Exchange. The NASDAQ is still smaller than the New York Stock Exchange, but not by much. It's a three-tier system, although most people don't know this and you don't care, but you can look it up. We're going to ask you to look up the exchange that the stock is on, and if you look closely, you'll see, you know, Global Select or Global or Capital Market. But they're just people just look at them on the on the NASDAQ. In the 1990s, this was done as a little dig to the New York Stock Exchange. They started positioning themselves in advertisements as the securities market of the future. In other words, you know, New York Stock Exchange is the securities market of the past. As it became apparent that the traditional face-to-face double auction model was not adequate to keep up with the massive increase of trading. And it's roughly about $22 trillion. So what was the, $27 trillion was the, I remember? Yeah, was the New York Stock Exchange. So it's, and remember, much of that is just because some of those companies are, well, Microsoft and Apple are $3 trillion, and I don't know how many trillion. I haven't checked Google lately, but so it's a handful of companies that are really making up the bulk of the NASDAQ. But still, it's still, now there's a two-horse race. Now there's a duopoly now. The New York Stock Exchange wasn't standing still, folks. They saw the handwriting on the wall. They realized that they had to go all electronic also. But as we said, they keep that floor, I think, just for television. Slide 31. Now, there are alternative trading systems. Many of the large players, mutual fund companies, pension funds, insurance companies, they really didn't want to buy and sell 100 shares or even 500 shares. They wanted to do 5,000 shares at a time. But they didn't get the best price on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ. So the third market was created so that institutional investors who traded in large blocks of securities could use the third market and trade with other institutions who are interested in buying 5,000 or 10,000 or however many thousand shares. It was still facilitated by a dealer, but it reduced the transaction costs. And one of the biggest ones here was the Intermarket, which was purchased by NASDAQ. See? Hey, we want to get in the action here. And then technology in the 1990s, as the internet came of age, created the fourth market. And these were kind of like eBay. If you ever done eBay or one of those other trading platforms where, you know, the system is there just to facilitate two people to get together. These were transactions made directly between starting with large institutional buyers and sellers of securities, but it allowed the institutions to bypass the dealers. They got rid of the middleman. They called them ECNs, electronic communication networks, privately owned electronic networks that automatically match buy and sell orders that customers place electronically. So you see, bypass the exchanges, bypass the NASDAQ, go directly to other, at first, institutional buyers. But because of the advances of technology, these third and fourth markets successfully started to court retail investors. So in other words, they're trying to create a system that's alternative to the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ that anybody can use. And a big example of this was Archipelago, which was then purchased by the New York Stock Exchange, and BATS, Better Alternative Trading System, which was started in a strip mall in Kansas City. Now think about that, folks. Before the internet, before new technologies, you had to be in New York. I mean, you had to be where the action is. Now you could start your own exchange in Kansas City in a strip mall, where the grocery store failed or whatever, and notice that it was purchased by the Chicago Board Options Exchange. So you see what's happening? They're all getting in each other's cookie jars and trying to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay, So, great. This is great, Pliano. You know, now we know about the concentrate on the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. Realize that those over-the-counter places are places you want to stay away from. And then the third and the fourth markets, you don't even deal with them anymore because they're owned by the big boys and girls here. And you might ask this question, or you might get this question from one of your friends and family and co-workers because they know you're learning about investments. Isn't the stock market all just one big malignant casino, huh? Well, you know what? It's a great question. And it's a legitimate question. Many people believe that. They look at some of the hanky-panky that goes on, especially when senators sell their shares, just as they learned before everybody else, that COVID's going to be a whole lot worse than the president is telling us. Yeah, the answer is yes and no. Huh? How could it be yes and no? How could the stock market all be one big malignant casino and not be all one big malignant casino? Malignant casino. Well, it depends on you. It depends on how you come to the capital markets, how you come to the stock markets. For some people, there are many individuals, yes, who see the markets as one big crapshoot. For them, the way to riches is to buy and sell, buy and sell, buy and sell. We don't call them investors. We call them speculators or traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S, not like the people on January 6th. It is very difficult, and you are up against the best in the business. Neophytes become very upset when the market turns against them. Now, you're going to hear a statistic of 1% or 2%, and it's probably right, but I don't think anybody really knows. But what you'll hear people say is, oh, only about 1% or 2% of traders stick with it. Most give up very quickly. And I know that's true, because I've talked to people who very quickly decided that this is not for them, and they've lost a lot of money, and they're not going to do that ever again until the next big bull market. But still, nobody really knows. But think about it, folks. You are up against the best in the business. Remember John Merriweather from Chapter 1? Yeah, don't be a speculator, don't be a trader, but it's your money. And the answer is no. Many others, and that's going to be you, look at the capital markets as a way to participate in the growth and prosperity of the global economy with a long-term orientation. Investors are usually very rewarded. You are going to be an investor. And we'll trot out, not for the last time, the definition by Benjamin Graham in The Intelligent Investor. An investment operation is one An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and an adequate return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. Oh, yeah? What about Enron? Well, many of you weren't even born then. Aren't all corporations crooks? Well, fraud in accounting, trickery, gimmicks have always been with us. They're always going to be with us. And there's a wonderful saying that's attributed to a bank robber. Why do you rob banks, Mr. Sutton, Willie Sutton? Because that's where the money is. He didn't actually say it. Some reporter said he said it, but it's a great answer, right? Why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Why is there fraud and accounting and trickery and gimmicks in the world of stocks? Because that's where the money is. Normally, but not always, these firms are regulated to the nether reaches of the OTC, the over-the-counter market. But for every one Enron, there are hundreds, no, thousands of companies that continue to do business with integrity and honesty, usually. Look, in 1973, there was a company called Equity Funding, a life insurance company. Folks, life insurance companies are like banks. How do you know they're making money? Their doors are open. Well, this company, I don't know how they thought they were going to get away with it, but they just went into a room and made up life insurance policies, made up people that didn't exist and said they were paying into the system. Didn't last. In 1986, it was Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken. And they were using a motel chain that you've probably seen around San Diego called Vagabond Inns to do insider trading. Yeah, check it. That's the movie Wall Street, which with Michael, the original one, Michael Douglas, was based on these two guys. In 2002, it was Enron, Global Crossing, Tyco, WorldCom. In 2008, it was Fannie, Freddie, Lehman Brothers, Citi, Wahoo, Wachovia, and AIG. And don't forget Bernie Madoff! 10 or 20 years from now, or maybe sooner, during the next big bull market craze, someone else will take their place. So it's just, we wish we could say that the system is perfect. It's not. It's not perfect. There are problems, and that's why you are going to do your due diligence, which is a fancy way of saying don't just choose a stock because somebody on the telly told you. We're going to learn about companies that have been around for decades and have done well in good times and, you know, held up pretty well in bad times. And yes, every once in a while, we want to have a hot, sexy stock that's going to explode on the upside or maybe implode on the downside. But stick with us. Stick with us. It really does make sense. Perfect. Slide 35. Recap. The securities markets exist to allow investors a safe, cost-effective method to participate in the success of the global market. And even with all the underhanded shenanigans, they have performed very well. And they are changing at they are changing at breakneck speed. That change is accelerating. Actually, it seems to have slowed down. Because as I said at the beginning, whether or not we ever have one or more global 24-hour trading markets remains to be seen, but it is exciting and for some people scary to watch, especially for those of us who have a stake in the outcome. And I would have to say really quickly, I disagree with the idea of a 24-hour trading market. You will see some people say, well, I do the trades after market. You're not getting the best prices, folks, because there's not as many people participating at that time. But hey, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Okay, so go back over. Make sure you understand the major players in the stock markets. And when we come back, we'll now take a look at transactions, transaction costs, and a little bit about where we get our information. Are you getting an education? I sure hope so. We're so proud of you. You are going to be the investment guru for your friends, your family, your coworkers. It is a very weighty responsibility. See you at our next presentation, dear students. Thank you very much for being in our class.